From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. About 40,000 large merchant ships are wandering the world with little or no regulation, vulnerable to accidents, piracy, and terrorism. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with William Longavisha, national correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly and author of the new book, The Outlaw Sea, A World of Freedom, Chaos, and Crime. Also, some of the ways in which Al-Qaeda has changed since September 11th. We talk with forensic psychiatrist and former CIA agent Mark Sageman, author of Understanding Terror Networks. He was an undercover operative in Pakistan during the end of the Afghan War with the Soviets and worked with the Afghani Mujahideen. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Acting on a U.S. warrant, British authorities have arrested a Muslim cleric known for his denunciations of the United States. Attorney General John Ashcroft announced the 11-count indictment against Abu Hamza al-Masri.
These charges are related to Hamza's alleged attempts in late 1999 and early 2000 to set up a training camp for violent jihad in Bly, Oregon.
Prosecutors also say al-Masri played a major role in a 1998 hostage crisis in Yemen in which three British citizens and an Australian were killed. His now-closed mosque in London attracted September 11th suspect Zacharias Moussaoui and shoe bomber Richard Reid. One of three women on the U.S.-appointed Iraqi Governing Council escaped assassination today. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports that gunmen attacked her convoy on the road between Baghdad and Najaf, killing three of her bodyguards.
According to witnesses and colleagues of the council member Salama al-Khafaji, her three-car convoy was traveling back from Najaf on the road to Baghdad, which is known to be a dangerous travel way, when unknown gunmen attacked the convoy. What we know is at least three bodyguards were killed, and Khafaji's son was reported missing.
NPR's Peter Kenyon in Baghdad. The attack came as U.S. forces suspended their offensive in Najaf. A spokesman for the U.S.-led administration says the U.S. Army will gradually hand over security in the holy city to Iraqi police. Spokesman Dan Senor says Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr pledged to recall his militia in a letter to Shiite leaders.
If Muqtada al-Sadr does in fact live up to the commitments he made to the Shia house, we will play our part.
Senor says al-Sadr will eventually have to comply with an arrest warrant that implicates him in the killing of a rival cleric last year. For now, that warrant has been delayed. Britain is sending more troops to Iraq, and the country's defense secretary has confirmed 370 soldiers are being deployed, many as a direct result of recent insurgent attacks in the British-controlled region. Suzanne Chislett reports.
Several British battalions are due to withdraw from Iraq in the coming months after completing their tours of duty, and Defence Secretary Geoff Hoon said it was sensible to send in replacements. But he also said some of those heading to Iraq will stay for just 3 months to help boost the physical defences around British bases. The latest deployments will bring the British contribution in Iraq to around 8,900. For NPR News, I'm Suzanne Chislett in London.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Industrials gained 95 points to close at 10,205. In active trading, the NASDAQ was up 8 points to 1984. This is NPR News. A former Alabama governor is among three people who face an 8-count federal indictment. Prosecutors say Don Siegelman was part of a scheme to circumvent the state's competitive bid process. Alabama Public Radio's Brett Tannehill has more.
Former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman, his former Chief of Staff Paul Hamrick, and Tuscaloosa physician Philip Bobo face charges of fraud and conspiracy. At the center of the controversy is Alabama's maternity care program, a Medicaid service created to help indigent pregnant women. U.S. Attorney Alice Martin says the state's competitive bid process was compromised.
Today's charges allege that corruption and the attempted corruption of that process denied Alabama citizens of the honest services of former Governor Siegelman and his Chief of Staff Paul Hamrick, all for the benefit of Dr. Bobo.
Prosecutors say former Governor Sigelman and Hamrick funneled $550,000 from the state's education budget to Bobo, who then used that money to pay off a competitor also seeking contracts for the maternity care program. The contracts were worth $100 million a year. Sigelman says he expects to be exonerated. For NPR News, I'm Brett Tannehill in Tuscaloosa, Alabama.
Connecticut Governor John Rowland has asked a court to block a subpoena ordering him to testify before a state House committee that's considering whether to impeach him. Rowland's lawyer said the committee subpoena violates the separation of powers because the committee hasn't told the governor what it wants him to testify about or laid out the standard for determining whether he should be tried. Rowland is accused of compromising his office by accepting gifts from state contractors, friends, and state workers. He's also being investigated by federal authorities. In stocks, the S&P 500 gained 6 to 1121. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Novo Nordisk, working to improve diabetes treatment in the U.S. For 80 years, diabetes care has been our passion, not just our business.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The sea has always been a relatively anarchic place. Piracy continues to be a menace. Ships have been attacked by terrorists, and the threat remains that terrorists could transport their weapons by sea. My guest William Longavisha says it has grown increasingly difficult for governments to control the oceans. He explains why in his new book, The Outlaw Sea, A World of Freedom, Chaos, and Crime. Longavisha is national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly. His other books include Inside the Sky, reflections on his experiences as a professional pilot, and American Ground, about the cleanup at Ground Zero and the culture that developed around it. He's currently working on a series of articles on the rebuilding of the Iraqi justice system. Longavisha says more than 40,000 large merchant ships are wandering the world with little or no regulation under the system that's become known as flags of convenience. I asked him to describe that system.
It started with World War II as an American governmental invention, in fact, to get around our own neutrality laws and to be able to provide goods to Great Britain. And in the years before we joined the war, we decided to take a lot of our own ships and flag them as Panamanian ships. This was, of course, Panama was really essentially almost like a colonial state of the United States at that time. And so we felt we could maintain control, and we did, and it was very effective. And after the war, that spread. But starting in the 1980s, especially, in fact, ironically, just at the time when the United Nations, the IMO, was trying to address the organic growth of these artificial flags, there was an explosion of this, an indirect reaction, I believe, to the explosion of regulations, in fact. This became the only way to do business on the high seas. If you didn't do this starting in the 1980s, it was no longer a choice, really, I think, for ship owners. If you didn't do it, you couldn't compete. The margins are razor thin, and you needed to milk the most efficiency out of your ships, which means that you needed to employ very cheap crews, and you needed to do minimal training and minimal maintenance on these ships, and just milk every ounce of efficiency from the operation if you wanted to survive in that business. It started in the 1980s, and it has grown since then.
Well, say I have a ship. What's the difference to me financially and in terms of the regulations I have to follow if I put a Liberian flag on versus if I put an American flag on it?
Well, the American flag, like many of the European flags, is quite extreme in that it requires American crews and their union rules. So the first thing is that your labor costs are much, much cheaper if you go to a third world country. Operationally, the regulations are very similar. Between the American rules about how you should operate and maintain your ship and, let's say, Liberian rules or Maltese rules or Tongan rules, Bolivian rules, they're all about the same, and they're all based on the IMO, the United Nations system out of London. The difference is in the enforcement. In the United States, the Coast Guard definitely enforces the regulations. So you not only have to comply with the regulations, whereas in other places, in the most egregious flags of convenience states, there is really no regulation.
So one of the problems that this flag of convenience system causes is that a lot of the ships aren't in as good shape as they ought to be sailing the seas. What are some of the other problems?
You know, I think that you can talk about flags of convenience as being a terrible, terrible problem. I'm not sure that it is. I mean, I'm really an observer rather than a worrier about this system.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways, I think we can celebrate the freedom and the internationalization that it represents. It certainly is a problem if you are a U.S. Sailor and you want to make a living. The flags of convenience means pretty much that you can't. Now, there's an exception to that. U.S. ships doing business within the United States from a U.S. port to another U.S. port are required by law to fly American flags and hire American crews. But that's limited business. Flags of convenience, from an American sailor's point of view, is a very bad thing because it means you don't have a job anymore. You better find some other line of work. From an environmentalist point of view, it certainly does lead to low-quality ships that have a habit of breaking apart suddenly because they're so old, typically in a storm, and spilling, in the case of spilling oil, for instance, crude oil or the products of oil, causing massive pollution. Ships would be doing that anyway. The Exxon Valdez, the famous American tanker that broke up in Prince William, that ran aground in Prince William Sound and spilled a lot of crude, was an American flag ship with an American crew. It was sailing from one American port to another. So there's not a direct relationship between flag of convenience and a huge problem with the environment, but there's a rough relationship. Should we worry about that? I'm not much of an environmentalist personally. I don't worry too much about that. I think there are other things that we can worry about before we worry about the occasional oil spill. Certainly, though, Europe has been blanketed by oil spills in recent years.
Well, it also seems that aboard a lot of these ships, you have a very multicultural staff, which sounds great, you know, multicultural crew. But the fact is that a lot of them can't communicate with each other. And if there's an emergency, that's a real problem.
There have been cases of ships running aground where afterward and during the investigation, it has been found that essentially the captain couldn't talk to the crew. That's, I think, rare. And some form of broken English seems to be the universal maritime language on these ships. So I think, generally speaking, that is not a huge problem. From a God's eye view, from God's perspective, this multinationalism is probably a good thing. I mean, all people are created equal, and the idea that the good jobs, or the jobs in general, should be the preserve of the West probably is questionable from God's point of view, if you know what I mean.
You do make some of these ships sound like multicultural floating sweatshops.
Well, they are. But of course, one person's sweatshop is another person's opportunity. And that's one of the problems we face. When looking at the ocean and when looking at the economies on land. So that who are we? I try in a way to say in this book, without lecturing the readers, to impose Western standards of labor on third world people. If that imposition means, in fact, if not in principle, in fact, that we take the jobs away from them and give them back to ourselves.
William Longavisha is my guest, and he's a correspondent for The Atlantic. His new book is called The Outlaw Sea, A World of Freedom, Chaos, and Crime. One of the issues you write about is piracy at sea. And, you know, piracy, I suppose, is related in some way to terrorism, too, because pirates can be terrorists. Piracy can become terrorism. Terrorism can be a form of piracy. And certainly we've already faced some acts of terrorism at sea, such as when the USS Cole was blown up by al-Qaeda in 2000, 11 months before September 11th. You say in your book that bin Laden is said to control up to 20 aging freighters. How much do you know about that?
I know very little about it. I think no one knows much about it. This is typical of the sea and of the world in which we live. It's very large, very complex, very easy to hide in. But it is, I think, generally thought that he does control freighters. There is one known case in 1998 in Tanzania of an al-Qaeda ship delivering explosives, which were then used in the embassy bombings. So this is, and there are other cases that are known. So that for the either for the transport of weapons or the transport of people, there is evidence that that bin Laden personally has been involved. Now, aside from that, he simply seems to be in the shipping business. I mean, much of what is transported on al-Qaeda ships, such as they are at any given month as they're traded and bought and sold, much of what is transported is just regular stuff, bulk, grain, and chickens for all I know. And for reasons of business and way of making money. And in the fit is natural and quite beautiful in a way. In other words, what interests me about this is the correlation or the similarity between the methods of business of regular ship owners, of this new form of extranational terrorist, and of this new form of extranational piracy. And these are sort of subsets. I mean, there are many terrorists in the world, and we use that word much too loosely these days. But if you look at the specific al-Qaeda form of terrorism, in which territory is really not the issue, and you look at this new form of piracy in which the groups involved are multinational, ephemeral, always changing, and are not tying themselves down by national allegiances, and you look at the way normal ships operate, you find a striking similarity. The purposes, of course, are quite different.
What is the new kind of piracy that you're talking about?
It's a subset of the sort of piracy. I mean, piracy has always existed, and I think there are reasons that can be explained why over the last 5 to 10 years, there's been an upsurge of sort of hand-wringing type of journalism in which we're bemoaning the rise of piracy. I think that's largely bogus. Most piracy is the old kind of piracy, which amounts to poor people sitting on a shore, seeing the wealth of the world go by and jumping out in little boats, outboard motors, going out there, hitting the ships as best they can, stealing things from the crew, maybe a little bit of cargo, and disappearing. Opportunistic acts that are similar to street crime. That's not very interesting, and that's always existed. And so that gets reported a lot, and all of these things get blurred, and as I say, there's much hand-wringing going on. But inside that, those numbers, is this other form of piracy that I report on in this book, and that is numerically not significant, but structurally significant. And that is, these are basically multinational gangs, much more sophisticated, that exploit national laws, that use laws and citizenship to hide in rather than running away from, and are quite sophisticated in the use of airlines, passports, and equipment. And they tend also to be ambitious. This goes hand in hand with the other. And they tend, rather than simply stealing a little bit, they steal the whole thing. So they take the whole ship, and they steal they unload the cargo onto the black market somewhere, and that's a lot of cargo. And then they take the ship, and they may change the name. They may then pose as a legitimate ship, do business somewhere in the world, grab another load of cargo as a legitimate ship, disappear with that. And eventually, maybe sell the ship, or just beach it somewhere. Finally, so they are in the habit often of killing the entire crew. These are very, very dangerous people.
You give an example in your book of the Alondra Rainbow, a ship that was captured by pirates. And as you say, you know, the pirates, they renamed the ship, they reflagged the ship, they disguised the ship, and no one could find it for quite some time. Who were the pirates who took the ship?
Typically, the trigger men, so to speak, the ones who put their feet on the decks, they came up the stern of the ship in Indonesia. This was in the last few weeks of 1999, in fact, when they hit that ship. It was loaded, headed for Japan. The crew was both Filipino, and the captain and first engineer, I believe, maybe captain and first engineer were Japanese. Ship was flagged in Panama, and it disappeared. The crew was put into after being held on another ship, a pirate ship, for a few weeks. They were put into a life raft and abandoned for dead. By chance, after 10 days in this life raft, they were rescued by a Thai fishing boat. But the ship had disappeared, and there had been quite a search mounted by various navies, including aircraft, for this ship, and it had simply disappeared. This would seem sort of to be a surprise to somebody who looks at a map and says, "Well, how can the modern world with technology such as it is, and satellites and this and that, how can a ship disappear?" The minute you get out on the ocean and begin to contemplate the actual size and turbulence of that mass of water, it becomes much easier to understand how a ship like that could disappear.
The pirates who took the Alondra Rainbow successfully hid it by repainting it, renaming it, reflagging it, and so on. But eventually, it was discovered. Were the pirates ever brought to trial?
The Indians chased them. The Indian Coast Guard chased them in international waters on a 2 or 3 day fight, during which they were simply shooting up the ship. The pirates were hiding in the engine room. The ship was proceeding at full speed on autopilot. They finally were forced to stop, and they were boarded. The Indian Coast Guard boarded them and arrested this crew of pirates. They took them to Mumbai, otherwise known as Bombay, and there was a trial. This trial was the first, at least in modern times, maybe ever, of a true international trial of international pirates. It's a complicated subject, but it was a landmark trial. And through the very slow process of Indian justice, they were finally convicted, and they were sent to prison in a city called Pune outside of Mumbai. I went to see them in the prison and talked to them about their experience.
My guest is William Longavisha. His new book is called The Outlaw Sea. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is William Longavisha, national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly. His new book is called The Outlaw Sea, A World of Freedom, Chaos, and Crime. So you've learned a little bit about piracy. Are the laws getting tightened at sea as a result of terrorism now? Are there more controls?
Yes, there are, and that's one of the things that interests me. I mean, the growth in laws related to security after 9/11 at sea is in many ways parallel to or similar to the growth in laws, the general growth in maritime laws that have been issued by the United Nations, the IMO in London. And it's one of the paradoxes of this story that governments really have no choice but to act as governments, so that the American reaction to the very real threat of terrorism coming at us from the sea via ship has been willy-nilly simply to create these regulations and to work through the existing structures of regulations like the IMO, which have proved to be meaningless, actually. And the people who are involved in this, in the security field in the United States, off the record, most of them will admit that that really these regulations are not going to be effective, and that this you cannot stop a terrorist attack from the sea because of the nature of the sea. You cannot stop a terrorist attack with yet more regulations. But in a way, they really have no choice. I mean, they've been, especially in the Coast Guard, they've been given the job of protecting American shores, and this is what they have to work with.
Do you think that another terrorist attack against the United States at sea is inevitable?
Not inevitable, but I think it's certainly one of the avenues available to terrorists to attack the United States, and in a big way, because of course a ship can carry a lot of material. The ship itself can be one hell of a weapon if it blows up in a harbor. And more, I think, significant, a ship can be used, given the sort of the anarchy and the difficulty of seeing what's going on in the ocean in normal business, a ship can be used to bring things into the United States, like devices, weapons. It can be used very well, because anything could be brought into the United States relatively easily via ship, much easier than bringing it in on an airplane, or for that matter, bringing it overland through our ports of entry across the Rio Grande or something like that.
Now, one of the pieces in your new book is about a subject I'd really given absolutely no thought ever in my life to until I read your piece. And it's about what happens to large ships when they're obsolete, when they're ready to be scrapped or junked. There's a part of the world that a lot of them go to now to meet their fate. What part of the world is that?
India. India and Bangladesh. In fact, they're in more than just a part of the world. There are two beaches. There's one in India called Malang, another in Bangladesh, just north of the big port of Chittagong. And the ships are sold to scrap dealers. They're rammed up onto these beaches, onto these shores, and they're torn apart by armies of the poor. And you're driving through farm fields, typically dusty, poor Indian peasants in the fields, poking at this parched earth, very Indian scene. And suddenly, beyond a tree line on a certain dirt track, suddenly you see the superstructure of a huge ship. It's as if the ship is growing out of the earth. It rises above the trees. It's a very unlikely thing suddenly to come upon. You go beyond the tree line, and it all unfolds in front of you. It's a Lang, and for miles along this coast, there is one ship after another, stretching into the horizon. I mean, down the beach lie hundreds of these ships, and they're huge because they've come out of the water. They've been rammed up on the shore, so you see the true size of these machines. And they are in various states of deconstruction. I mean, they're being torn apart by hand.
By hand and like hammer?
Crowbar, hammer, and cutting torches using cooking gas, which is a low-temperature form of cutting torch. And mostly simply by sweat and willingness to work and willingness to take risks.
William Longavisha is national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly. His new book is called The Outlaw Sea, A World of Freedom, Chaos, and Crime. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. From Barnes & Noble, now featuring My Soul Looks Back in Wonder, Voices of the Civil Rights Experience by Juan Williams, available at Barnes & Noble stores and at bn.com. By audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. From Endless Pools, a treadmill for swimmers, allowing people to swim at home year-round, indoors or outside. DVD or video available at 877-ENDLESS. That's 877-ENDLESS or endlesspool.com. And by Knopf, publisher of Eventide, the new novel by Kent Haraf, author of Plainsong. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, misconceptions about why people join terrorist networks. We talk with Mark Sageman, author of Understanding Terror Networks. He's a forensic psychiatrist and former undercover CIA agent. He worked with the Afghan Mujahideen in the late 80s during the Afghan War with the Soviets.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new book, Understanding Terror Networks, was written by a former CIA agent. But you wouldn't know that from reading the book. It wasn't until after its completion that the author, Mark Sageman, revealed he'd worked undercover with the Afghan Mujahideen when he was based in Pakistan in the late 80s. In a few minutes, he'll explain why he recently revealed his secret identity. Sageman is a forensic psychiatrist who now teaches at the University of Pennsylvania and its Center for Study of Ethno-Political Conflict. His new book challenges some preconceptions about why people join jihadi groups. His conclusions are based on his study of biographical data on 172 participants in the jihad. I asked him first about his reaction to the Bush administration's new warning that al-Qaeda is plotting a major attack on the U.S. this summer. Now, we were just warned by the FBI and the Justice Department that al-Qaeda or terrorists are planning another major attack in the United States, and there's particular fears that the attack might be against big events like the political conventions. What do you think about when you hear that?
Well, there's no doubt that al-Qaeda really wants to hurt the United States, so their desire is real. But what has changed since 9/11 is the vigilance inside the United States and at the borders preventing them from performing such a large operation. So I tend to be fairly skeptical, not so much because of the al-Qaeda desire to actually carry out such operation, but our ability to stop them.
Okay, so you're skeptical that the terrorists will actually be successful at pulling off another terrorist attack over the summer. But let me point out something else that you've said. The Bush administration says that we've succeeded in killing or imprisoning much of the leadership of al-Qaeda. And you've said, sure, that's the 2001 leadership that we've done away with, but now there's the 2004 leadership, and we haven't hurt them. So if you think that al-Qaeda is back with a new leadership, in spite of all the people who we've killed or imprisoned, why are you reasonably sure that they wouldn't be successful in pulling off a terrorist attack?
My level of certainty is really to the side of the attack, as opposed to carrying out an attack. I mean, you can always have a single person, a singleton, going out to the LL counter, let's say in Los Angeles, and kill two people. That is almost impossible to prevent. But what's very possible to prevent is a large-scale operation. And since 9/11, al-Qaeda has changed quite a bit. The new leadership is a very young, aggressive, reckless leadership. And so operation after 9/11 have multiplied. There are far more operation after 9/11 against targets all over the world than were before 9/11, but they were poorly planned. And were not as lethal as 9/11, even though perhaps the Madrid bombing was extremely lethal. But again, this was a fairly a rush job. It was put together in about 6 to 8 weeks.
Can you talk a little bit more about the difference between the new al-Qaeda leadership and the pre-9/11 al-Qaeda leadership?
Yes, it seemed that before 9/11, they had a more hierarchical overlay or over the various clusters of small organization in various countries, and they were able to coordinate a little bit better. This was a much older type of leadership, if you can call it leadership. What happened is after you degrade the network by really eliminating the communication between leaders that can help in terms of planning and money and training and even give advice, you local people, aggressive local young men, then step into those gaps. And, for instance, like al-Zarqawi that we hear a lot right now.
This is the man believed to be the person who decapitated Nick Berg.
That's correct, yes. So you almost select. It's for young, aggressive leaders to local leaders, not really global leaders anymore, but local leaders like, for instance, perhaps Amer Azizi in Madrid. And those leaders, if you think of the analogy of the war on drugs, where the police comes in and arrests the fellow who's at the street corner, well, there's a gap. And what happens is that you have an intense internal competition and the most aggressive wins out. So you have a progressive self-selection for aggression and aggressive young leaders who may not have the global vision of the old leadership, but are just as lethal locally.
So it sounds from what you're saying that you think in some ways we're better off than we were before September 11th in terms of being able to stop terrorist threats. But in other ways, we're worse off because we have a younger, more reckless leadership, and there's probably a lot more people out there who see themselves as potential suicide bombers or terrorists.
That's correct. I think that's exactly right.
The International Institute for Strategic Studies just released a report saying that overall the risk of terrorism to Westerners and Western assets in Arab countries appears to have increased after the Iraq War. Agree with that?
No. I smiled when I saw the number 18,000 members of Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is an organization. That network has what I call fuzzy boundaries. That means that it's very hard to actually tell who is in Al-Qaeda and who is not. It has now become more of a series, a collection of local organizations where local young men decide to, with their friends, carry out operation. Do they think of themselves as Al-Qaeda? Probably not. And this was a case in Casablanca. They were part of the overall movement called Jihadia Salafia, but they didn't even call themselves that. It's usually journalists and local law enforcement officers who put a label on this movement. It's really a bunch of friends getting together and carrying out those operations. So when I see 18,000, there is no formal induction into Al-Qaeda anymore. And I'm just wondering how do they go about looking at this number? There is no doubt to my mind, because of what happened in Iraq, that the potential number of people who want to carry out this operation has grown. But whether they will or not is an open question.
And you don't think they're all reporting to the same guy?
Well, again, the hierarchical levels of command has broken down. So it's really very much a collection of local phenomena.
My guest is forensic psychiatrist Mark Sageman, author of Understanding Terror Networks. He'll explain why he recently revealed he's a former undercover CIA agent after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mark Sageman. He teaches at the University of Pennsylvania. He's a former CIA agent and author of the new book, Understanding Terror Networks. In your book, you've tried to profile, to do portraits of people who join terrorist networks and understand why do they join. And you say that some of the myths, some of the assumptions that we make about why people join are really myths. They're not joining because they were indoctrinated. They're not joining because they were poor. A lot of the people are middle class. And you say that a lot of the reasons why people join is because they know other people in it. Could you talk about that? Why would that be a motivation?
Yes. Most people who actually join are part of the social group. In my data kind of fell into four large clusters, and they each have a separate type of perhaps not profile, but ways of getting to terrorist operation. The one that we would call the core Arab cluster really consists of really the elite of the core Arab world. And by core Arab world, I mean the Egyptian, Jordanian, Yemenis, Kuwaitis, Saudis. And because they're very the elite and they're good students, they send abroad to study. And while they're abroad, they become homesick and they become a little bit alienated, distant from their cultural bonds and the bonds to their friends. And they feel homesick, and therefore they drift toward mosques because that's where familiar sights and people are. They don't do that out of religiousness. They do that for social reason. And and when they're there, they kind of befriend other people. And they often move into apartments. For instance, the cell in Hamburg was exactly created that way. And there is an intensification there. They become of feelings and of friendship bonds and become very close to each other and very distant from the rest of their ambient society. So you have out-group hate and you have in-group love. And at the end of that process, they often are all willing or they all desire to join the jihad. And they do that collectively as a group. For instance, the Hamburg group, all eight of them decided to go to Afghanistan, and they went there in two waves. The first wave was, of course, the four pilots, and the second wave were the people who supported them.
There was a flowchart in The Atlantic magazine recently that you put together showing the leadership and the structure of al-Qaeda. It's the equivalent of like a corporate flowchart, but for al-Qaeda. But unlike a corporate flowchart where there's the CEO at the top, the vice president's beneath the CEO, the middle manager's beneath that, it's kind of a pyramid. So what your flowchart is more of a flowchart showing who knows who rather than who takes orders from who.
That's correct, because most of the orders, most of the operations are decentralized, and it's more of a collective decision-making process as opposed to a single person making up a plan. And in my book, I argue that that type of strict, rigid, hierarchical flow of information is a sure recipe for failure, especially in terrorist operation. You really needed an informal network to be able to overcome the inevitable obstacles that you have in the field. Because when you want to actually perform a terrorist operation, you actually don't know what the target is, you don't know how you're going to do it, you don't know who you're going to do it with. So you really need a lot of flexibility and a lot of horizontal flow of information between the members who are going to carry it out to be able to carry out that type of operation.
You know, you have a file that you keep, a matrix of people who are known to be in the international jihadi movement, and who knows who, who's affiliated with who. And after the terrorist attack on Madrid, you went into that network and came up with some interesting information. What did you find?
Yes. If you recall, the Madrid operation happened on a Thursday. By Saturday, the Moroccan authorities released the three names of the three suspects. So one of them was Jamal Zougham, and I ran Jamal Zougham against my database, which included Judge Baltazar Garzon's 700-page indictment. And his name, Zougham's name, appear on page 89 and 285 of the indictment. And it said that he was very close to Yarkas, Barakat Yarkas, who is also named Abu Dada. And he was the head of the Al-Qaeda Spanish cell. So I finally made the link to Al-Qaeda. That was on Sunday morning, emailed the information to CNN, which released it as a worldwide scoop from Madrid on Sunday.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Mark Sageman. He teaches at the University of Pennsylvania. He's the author of the new book, Understanding Terror Networks, and he's a former CIA agent. But you wouldn't know he's a former CIA agent, no matter how closely you read his new book. And that is because, Mark, you were not out of the closet, so to speak, about being a former CIA agent when you wrote this book. It was only after you wrote it that you revealed you are a former agent. What made you reveal that part of your past?
Mainly two things. One is, of course, the Valerie Plame affair. I came into the agency in 1984 as a NOC, which is an unofficial cover officer, which are the assignment of being sent abroad without being linked to official Americans like an embassy. And, of course, you can then go to denied areas, areas denied to official Americans. And this is very dangerous because you don't have the safety net of being an official American where you have diplomatic immunity. So if you're arrested, you may be shot. And this was the position that Valerie Plame was at. So I felt very strongly about this. Larry Johnson, who is, of course, the person who spearheads a movement to find out who leaked the name, asked me to put my name to a letter that he sent to Congress, and so I signed that letter. That's number one. And the second reason is the superb book by Steve Cole that revealed a lot of the programs that I started and ran for 3 years in Afghanistan.
And Steve Cole is the author of a book about Afghanistan, and he's with the Washington Post. He's an editor there.
That's correct. It's called Ghost Wars.
Can you talk about what your job was when you were undercover with the CIA, based in Pakistan and working with Afghanistan?
Most of my job consisted of leveling the playing field. If you remember, all
and I should say this is like 87 to 89 we're talking?
That's correct. Okay. That was at the end of the Afghan War, before the Soviets had publicly stated that they were going to withdraw, and up to the time of the withdrawal. So my program was really designed for three purposes. One was this, level the playing field, which means we were going to unilaterally, unbeknownst to the Pakistanis, was not declared to the Pakistanis, to provide support and advice to commanders that have been neglected or relatively neglected by the Pakistanis. The second, we wanted to make sure that the Pakistanis were really being honest with us, so I was collecting information on what the Pakistanis were doing. If you recall, there was a lot of money involved, and there were a lot of concern around Washington that perhaps some of that was siphoned out into their own pockets. And it turned out that the Pakistanis actually were pretty honest in terms of helping us run the war. And the third was, of course, to collect information on how the war was going and develop our own unilateral contacts to find out.
Why did you want to join the CIA?
That's a very good question. I'm a child of Holocaust survivors. And in a way, since I was born after World War II, I never really got to defend my family, perhaps retrospectively. And but children of Holocaust survivors always have the Holocaust on their mind. So when I was in Japan as a flight surgeon for the U.S. Navy, all the rumors of the genocide in Cambodia came out. And it was very hard to believe that this was happening again. And I felt the military was not doing very much. So I simply wrote a letter to the CIA and said, gee, you guys may actually, you know, you may want me. You know, I speak foreign languages. I'm a physician. And of course, by return mail, they said, yes, we do. And my security clearance and my process of joining took about a year.
So you thought that if you joined the CIA, you would be more useful than you are in the military in terms of helping to stop this type of genocide?
Yes. If you remember, you know, the next genocide to me after Cambodia was, of course, Afghanistan. The early years of the Soviet invasion, about 1.5 million Afghans were killed. 8 million were displaced. 5 million were outside refugees. 3 million were in Pakistan. 2 million were in Iran. And you had 3 million internally displaced, where they swelled up the population of Kabul and Kandahar and Mazar-e-Sharif, names that now we're all familiar, but at that time nobody was. And so to me, this was as much a disaster as any large-scale epidemic. So I was still a physician looking at it from a humanitarian point of view, and I thought that this was a very clear-cut situation that the Soviets had to go back to to prevent or to stop this genocide that was going on in Afghanistan.
Okay, so you go to Islamabad to try to help prevent this kind of mass death in Afghanistan. You're a Holocaust survivor. Your parents are Holocaust survivors. You're Jewish. And you're now based in a part of the world that is growing, at that time, increasingly anti-Semitic. And now, I mean, we see how truly rapidly anti-Semitic the jihadi movement is. How aware were you then of this kind of growing strain of anti-Semitism?
Well, the Afghans were not really anti-Semitic during the war. Some of them argued that there's a lost tribe. The Afghan the Pashtun tribes, were the lost tribes. But if you recall, at the time, Yasser Arafat, the chairman of the PLO, was very pro-Soviet, and therefore he supported the Soviet Union in their policy on Afghanistan, and every Afghan knew that. And so they were not pro-Palestinian, because to them, Yasser Arafat was the head of the Palestinian people. And in my contact with a lot of the Afghan mujahideen, they were telling me, gee, after we finish with the Soviets here, well, we can go to Israel and clean up the mess for you. And I was saying, no, please, don't muddy the situation.
So you didn't have to hide the fact that you were Jewish?
Oh, yes, I did.
You did hide it?
Yes.
Why?
Well, as you kind of pointed out, Al-Qaeda now claims that it was Allah, or God, that conquered the Soviet Union. And I didn't really want them to know that behind Allah stood Jehovah in Pakistan. That would just muddy the water, not only with the Afghans, but also with the Pakistani inter-services intelligence directorate, who would probably have put more surveillance on me, which is something I definitely did not need. So I decided to actually have a low profile.
My guest is forensic psychiatrist and former CIA agent Mark Sageman. His new book is called Understanding Terror Networks. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is forensic psychiatrist and former CIA agent Mark Sageman. His new book is called Understanding Terror Networks. Part of what you do now is you work as a forensic psychiatrist.
Yes.
So you you deal with crime, you've dealt with serial killers, and of course you're still doing work on understanding terrorists and the jihadi network. Do you see any connection between, say, the mind of a serial killer and the mind of a terrorist, only because they both end up committing murder?
No, actually, I don't. But I almost had to have that experience with serial killers for me to understand the difference. I see terrorism really as very much a group phenomenon, or terrorism, the Al-Qaeda type of terrorism, as opposed to, for instance, a Ted Kaczynski, who also could be considered as terrorist. But Ted Kaczynski was a loner. And the loners may have something wrong with them psychologically or psychiatrically. And so a serial murderer or a mass murderer, and they're very different, may have something psychologically wrong with them, and they're loners, and they act out of their internal drive. But terrorism is very, very different. It's really a group phenomenon. You can't really have terrorism like Al-Qaeda without having friends to motivate, sustain your design, your enthusiasm, especially when you kill yourself the same way a lot of the Al-Qaeda agents have. This is very much you're doing it for your comrades and for your God. But in fact, he's really doing it for his friends. He's really trying to show the ultimate loyalty to this band of brothers. And we've known that for a long time, since all the studies were done on soldiers in World War II, where people fought because of their friend, not because of any ideological reason, up to just about any kind of studies in social psychology in the last half century. This has supported this view of why people do those things.
So you actually see a connection between suicide bombers and the American soldier, that both are willing to give their lives for their comrades, but the concept of how and why are really different.
That's correct. And if you see most Medal of Honor winners are people who jumped on a grenade to save their bodies. I think it's almost a majority. And it's similar, except people tell you, well, perhaps the guy who jumped on the grenade didn't have time to think about it. But you see, I think the instinct is very similar.
Now, it's just been a couple of months, maybe, since you came out as a former CIA agent. How has your life changed? I imagine people who know you are kind of stunned to find that out.
Many people suspected. People who knew me suspected. Probably my family was probably the most surprised.
Your family didn't know?
Yes, my parents, my sister, they didn't know. My niece did not know. My wife did know, I told her. But it's still the same old me.
What was your parents' reaction?
I'm not really sure they still understand.
Right, right. Mark Sageman, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Mark Sageman is a forensic psychiatrist and former CIA agent. He teaches at the University of Pennsylvania and its Center for Study of Ethno-Political Conflict. His new book is called Understanding Terror Networks. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Vintage Books, publishers of the new paperback Beyond Belief by Elaine Pagels, author of The Gnostic Gospels. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, we listen back to an interview with longtime peace activist David Dellinger. He died on Tuesday at the age of 88. He was one of the Chicago Seven, the group of anti-war organizers tried on charges of conspiracy to riot at the 1968 Democratic National Convention. Join us for the next Fresh Air.